Good afternoon. My name is Angie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AAAS Science conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you have already done so, please press the pound sign now. Then press star one again to ensure your question is registered. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Mr. Chubin. You may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Dr. Darryl Chubin, Director of the Center for Advancing Science and Engineering Capacity at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I am pleased to announce that, with participation by the Association of American Universities, AAAS is releasing a comprehensive legal and program handbook titled Navigating a Complex Legal Landscape to Foster Greater Faculty and Student Body Diversity in Higher Education. This handbook was developed to help U.S. higher education meet a critical national need to increase the participation by racial and ethnic minorities and women in the U.S. science and technology workforce, and to make measurable progress in the near term. For the reporters and university leaders on the line, be aware that we are recording this teleconference. We are honored to have with us today former Education Secretary Richard Riley, who will offer a few opening remarks. Secretary Riley.
Thank you so much, Darryl. I'm truly pleased to be here today as part of this release of these important resources, this handbook that's so very important. And it's for the purpose of helping guide colleges and universities that are focused on enhancing diversity of our students and faculties who are pursuing science, technology, and engineering and math, the so-called STEM fields. As we all know, these are indispensable areas of focus for our 21st century economy, and we must take proactive steps to ensure that we are tapping all of the talent and resources that we have at our hands to ensure that we meet the nation's needs and also the needs of opportunity for young people coming along during this century. The good news, as we will hear more about here, is that there are many educationally sound and legally supportable positions that can be taken to advance our goals of enhancing the diversity of our nation's students and faculty who are focused on STEM issues. I want to extend my appreciation to AAAS and to AAU for their leadership in this important issue. It's a very important issue, and I thank you both, both groups, for placing it as a priority, and I thank all those who are participating in this conference.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. To further introduce our discussion, let's look at demographic trends in the college-age population. The robustness of our nation's intellectual resources depends on increasing interest, access, and participation rates in science and technology fields for women, who already comprise the majority of the U.S. college population, and for individuals who are racial and ethnic minorities and who will soon become the majority of our college population. We must prepare all of our students to live and work successfully in a diverse global society and workforce. Yet research tells us that classrooms and workplaces are cultural cauldrons. The teaching and learning of science is not immune from various biases. Programs in and out of classrooms have therefore been designed to control biases and support the success of all participants. At the same time, programs must be conducted in a legal landscape that is complicated and barrier-laden. The rhetoric that surrounds this issue is often heated and unduly restrictive. Words such as quotas and reverse discrimination are often invoked. But race-neutral alternatives are not the only path to careers in our merit-based society. We need a partnership of educators, policy leaders, and lawyers to design and implement effective and legally sustainable diversity programs. The handbook we released today provides examples of field-tested tools for diversifying faculties and student bodies. The handbook is part of a AAAS project that was chiefly funded by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, with additional funding from the National Science Foundation. The project was conceived and co-directed by a team consisting of myself, Dr. Shirley Malcolm, AAAS Head of Education and Human Resources Programs, and Ms. Jamie Lewis Keith, Vice President and General Counsel of the University of Florida. Ms. Keith is also the editor of the handbook, an author, and the director of all legal work on the project. I turn to her now for an opening comment. Jamie.
Thank you, Daryl. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you to AAAS for its longstanding commitment to the issues we are highlighting today. I'm going to set the stage for our question and answer session, which is going to be the main focus of today's call, after making a few acknowledgments. The Association of American Universities, represented by its president, Dr. Robert Berdahl, and its executive vice president, Dr. John Vaughn, have been our partners in the development of the handbook and the associated workshops held in 2009 for general counsels, provosts, and other senior academic leaders of 35 AAU institutions. AAU's member research universities produce the largest number of science and technology doctoral degrees in the United States, and its leadership and participation with AAAS have been central to the project. The project's outside counsel and primary authors of the handbook are two teams of national legal and policy experts. From Education Council LLC are Art Coleman, who also chairs the project's advisory board, and Stephen Winnick, Jennifer Ripner, and Scott Palmer. Education Council focused on student diversity while also contributing broadly to the project, and Art Coleman represents Education Council on today's panel. From Fulbright and Jaworski LLP are Robert Burgoyne and Theodore Shaw, with their colleagues Ralph Dawson and Rena Schenkman. Fulbright focused on faculty diversity while also contributing broadly to the project, and Bob Burgoyne represents Fulbright on today's panel. The project's advisory board contributed critical expertise, and I ask you to look at the beginning of the handbook, which lists its members. Now I want to introduce two defining features of the handbook leading into the question and answer session. First, in the handbook, Drs. Chubin and Malcolm of AAAS makes a compelling case for diversity in science and technology fields, contributing policy expertise and providing hard data. This foundation for the legal analysis in the handbook demonstrates that diversity is as critical to excellence in science and technology as it is in law or humanities. Second, the handbook was developed as a resource that uniquely provides college and university lawyers with comprehensive, in-depth legal materials pegged to particular models and types of effective diversity programs rather than just abstract legal analysis. The handbook covers a host of governing constitutional, statutory, and regulatory regimes, and the primary federal and state case law for lawyers, as well as rich program and policy resources for provosts and academic leaders. Now we are ready to begin our question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question of our panel of Art Coleman from Education Council, Bob Burgoyne of Fulbright and Jaworski, and Dr. Shirley Malcolm of AAAS, please call the number on your screen. The lawyers on the call may want to note that this session focuses on the big picture and the policy-law interface. The materials in the handbook go into depth on the tough legal issues, but we can't do that in this forum. While the first calls come in, I'll get us started with a question for Art Coleman. The first question is, why is diversity in science and technology fields a national imperative, regardless, really, of differing political perspectives? If we focus on quality, recruiting the best and the brightest based on merit, won't we get where we need to go? Art?
Thanks, Jamie, and thanks to AAAS and AAU for sponsoring this call. Let me jump to that question. I think actually the bottom line is, yes, if we focus on quality, we can get there. I think the real challenge and part of the focus of this guide is how to focus on getting to quality, and I think given the data that Daryl has already alluded to that is detailed in some fashion in the beginning sections of this manual,
regarding the demographic projections and the historical underrepresentation of women and minorities in the STEM fields, given the growth of the underrepresented minority population projected for coming decades, we have a significant challenge. And so, in a sense, how do we get smarter? And I think part of what we're trying to do with this guide is to outline a number of very practical systemic steps that are both significantly educationally grounded with research behind them, but as an experience behind them, but as well with support in a very complex maze of legal laws, rules, and policies to help streamline the picture of what you can do as a matter of good education practice and legal practice. And I think the marriage of the need for connecting diversity broadly with the whole enterprise of science may be best captured, if I can make one reference to page 14 in a quote by a physics professor, James Gates, at the University of Maryland. He says this: "The identification, recognition, and exploitation of multiple distinct pathways for asking questions about and solving scientific problems often precedes discovery and sometimes head-spinning new paradigms. These new answers and advances in science aid its evolution and avoid the fate of becoming a static state of knowledge." I think that singularly captures the scientific challenge in the 21st century and aligns very well with the whole focus on how we assemble classes of stimulating thought leaders and participants around key questions involved in STEM.
Thank you, Art. Operator, next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Ilana Long with King University.
Hi.
Hi.
I think this is a great thing you're doing. I did have a question on it, though. I noticed that within it, it is lacking in anything revolving around lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender issues. And I was wondering if that's something that is going to be looked into for future future updates on it, or basically how can we work together to get that to be involved as part of such a great document that's been made.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, would you want to respond to this?
Certainly. I think that you're right. The materials do not focus on that issue specifically. However, they very much focus on the fact that the kind of diversity that we're talking about as being compelling for the nation and for this time is broad diversity, including the many aspects of individuals that contribute to a robust academic environment. And clearly, individuals' sexual orientation and gender identity, all those kinds of diversity issues are also part of the overall broad diversity. I think the legal issues around those particular diversity factors are in some respects different than gender and race, because the Supreme Court, whether or not you think this is good policy, the Supreme Court has not ascribed particularly protected status to those factors, and therefore it is easier, in a sense, for institutions from a legal perspective to choose those factors as some of the diversity factors that can be considered in programs to increase diversity.
Good. Thank you. Next question.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your question from the queue. We will pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your next question comes from the line of Lauren Schickman with Science Magazine.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I know this is probably a tough one to answer because there are so many different pieces of legislation involved and so many different kind of programs that you can do, but I was wondering if there are any recommendations you could mention as being, or model programs you could mention as being particularly effective that you found that were just really good at fitting within the legal framework and being very successful.
Mm-hmm. I actually would like to have both Dr. Malcolm and Mr. Burgoyne respond to this. So who would like to go first?
Well, I'll defer to Dr. Malcolm. You know, mine's more the legal end, and my guess is Jamie is probably the
We'll pass this one around, Bob. Thank you.
not to pass the buck, Jamie.
No, we'll get back to you. Shirley.
I think that one of the most successful strategies has been that of paying attention, actually collecting the data, being attentive to what is going on inside of one's own institutions. It is amazing the extent to which attention itself and actually looking for the broadest range of people is actually an effective way to start to announce within one's mission and within one's vision that you're interested in quality and diversity. And I think that that is one of the best ways actually to begin.
How about Jamie? Sure. You want to try to put that into a legal frame?
Sure, and let me try to give two examples of that. Actually, I think one of the things that the handbook points out is that it's very important for us to take advantage of some of the things that are very clearly legally sustainable and actually are critical in the real world to achieving diversity. One of them concerns the search and outreach process, which many institutions don't, in fact, pay as much attention to as they could. If we really start with how we describe our qualification requirements, not in any way lowering our academic credentials and standards, but if we avoid the notion that there is only one program or there are only four programs that produce qualified people for a particular discipline, and we really require the search committees to undertake the hard work of finding the individuals wherever they are who are particularly talented as scholars and show real promise, we can often increase the diversity of the pool from which we recruit. Also, if we focus on certain conduct of individuals, and we talk about this as multicultural skills or conduct of inclusion in the materials, if we look for individuals who have a record of actually working with individuals who are different than themselves, who have either scaled barriers themselves or broken down barriers for others and actually exhibit that conduct in the way they undertake their work, we can identify individuals of all races and genders and backgrounds who will actually create an environment of inclusion and increase the diversity. And in our world where individuals who are minorities or women often have different experiences than others, we will probably also increase the actual diversity of our faculty and student body.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't go into as much detail as the handbook does, but if you look at the neutral alternatives chapter of the handbook, you will find some of these very good examples.
Mm-hmm. Let me stay with this for a moment. Although the handbook has focused on the two different bodies of law, one that applies to students and the other that applies to the workforce, there is a category of participant in science that falls somewhat between, and that's postdoctoral appointees. I'm wondering if someone on the line would care to comment on the status of postdocs in universities as students or as employees?
Sure, I'd be happy to field that.
Thanks, Bob.
We actually have a separate section in the handbook that addresses this, and what you'll see in that section is that as a legal matter, the courts have concluded that in some circumstances, postdocs are employees and subject to the set of laws that govern the employment relationship. In another context, they are students. And the determining factor has generally been the nature of the action that is at issue in the given lawsuit. If it's, you know, a termination from a particular position, that's more likely to be viewed as an employment-related issue. If it has to do with whether or not the individual is performing up to the standards of the institution, that's generally viewed more as an educational issue and more in the camp of a student-school relationship rather than employment.
I know that Shirley and Art have taken on this issue as well, and I'm wondering if they, either of them, would like to comment.
Daryl, thank you. I would agree with everything Bob just said, and then just as a point of amplification, because I think it's implicit in the conversation thus far, and it's hopefully quite explicit in the written materials, to say that there is a fundamental policy frame and alignment between the focus on student issues and faculty issues for the purposes of this question of diversity in STEM fields, not surprisingly. At the same time, there are distinct legal questions that get raised, for instance, in an employment setting that will not in the same way get raised in a student setting. That being said, part of the effort here is to navigate that terrain, pointing to those synergies and points of correspondence as a frame to guide decision-making, even as there are, in fact, very distinct questions, for instance, under Title VII in employment that don't pertain to student issues. So maybe that sort of helps set the context here, particularly given the way Bob responded to that question in terms of some individuals being considered both.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just add one quick point, I think that the one thing the materials do is to actually provide a list of design considerations when you are when you're actually designing a program for postdoctoral fellows, for instance, so that you know if you design that program in one way, it is more likely to present more situations in which the individual will be regarded as an employee. And if you design it another way, you may be able to create a situation where the individual is considered a student for more purposes, and there's an explanation of how the law differs and why it might be more beneficial to treat an individual, for instance, as a student than as an employee in certain disciplines.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the larger issue of the relationship of the postdoc within the research community and within any particular institution is complex in any case. On the one hand, what is that person expected to contribute to the work with which, or to the laboratory or to the scholar researcher with whom they are associated? And on the other hand, what are they expected to get from that individual? In some cases, there is this notion that you really need some kind of expectations that are laid out from the beginning on both sides to begin to clarify that. And I would say that most institutions really have really struggle with the issue of postdocs because it cuts in many directions. If you are a student, it's true. You can basically have certain kinds of expectations with regard to mentoring, with regard to engagement in the research, but you may not be able to get benefits. So there's a lot of complexity that is framed here, far beyond the legal aspects. In terms of the relationship of these individuals to a lab, to a department, and to an institution.
Thank you. I'm informed that the question queue is empty, which raises the prospect of those of us on the phone having another conversation, which we love to do. Let me, while people consider what's on their mind, we've got two questions that are waiting, so I'll hold my question and ask the operator to introduce the caller.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa Jennings with MentorNet.
Hello. I believe Dr. Malcolm just mentioned mentoring very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious to know if there were any unique findings in the development of this handbook on mentoring practices or patterns among the diverse student population.
Shirley, would you like to take a crack at that?
Well, this is a tough one because it's not really clear to me that that's kind of with inside of the scope here. On the other hand, there are research findings that do relate to mentoring, especially as they affect people's ability to either succeed as a student or to basically be able to succeed as a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
Because after you're hired, the hiring of a faculty member is just the beginning of a process.
Mm-hmm.
The articulation of the expectation of what it's going to take for you to advance and get promoted is something that is another part of it and usually involves mentoring. There are findings that from a number of institutional studies that there is inconsistent mentoring that goes on across different groups. And I think that is a real challenge programmatically because that's an area that talks about the contribution of an institution or a department to the success of an individual, whether you will be promotable because you clearly understand what the expectations are that are being put before you.
Let me add on the student side. There are findings, in fact, one that I believe emerged from a MentorNet study that showed that students of color actually claim to benefit more from mentoring than non-minorities. That's an interesting finding. I'm not sure how we explain it. But there is, another emerging trend, which is a companion of that, which says that students are no longer thinking about mentoring as a one-to-one relationship with one mentor only. Rather, the student recognizes that different mentors have different expertise and can help with different aspects of their education or career development, and that consequently this is really a web of support, a network, if you will, which needs to be nurtured and which changes as one progresses through the career course.
Carol, if I could add that
sure.
one of the things I think the handbook tries to do, going back to some comments that Art and Shirley made today, is to focus on the fact that it's very important to have an evidentiary foundation
right. For
any of your diversity efforts. And if you and going to what Shirley said, if you pay attention to the mentoring that an institution is doing, and you keep track of the mentoring that an institution is doing, and you find that your own institution actually has a gap,
mm-hmm.
and you are not paying enough attention to effective mentoring for women and minorities or other underserved groups, then you may have a more compelling legal justification for having some focused mentoring for those groups that are not being effectively mentored. So I think that's one of the important thrusts of the and advice that's in the handbook.
I agree. Just to underscore that, with regard to all of the issues that we're discussing, the handbook is firm in recommending that one document what one is doing, progress over some baseline, something systematic, something that's comparative across units of the institution, so that the legal case that ultimately may need to be made for operating a program or operating it in a particular way is not based on anecdotes alone and on sheer rhetoric. Data really do matter here.
Daryl, this is Art. If I can just add to that.
Absolutely.
This may just be the lawyer coming out in me, but I feel compelled to say that both nothing that we are saying here nor anything that the readers will see in the guide should be construed as institution-specific legal advice.
All right.
While we have attempted to identify what we believe are legally sustainable strategies and models, and to highlight some programmatic examples, each of these has to be understood in an institution-specific context because every institutional mission is different. And as we know from the University of Michigan, and I think this will track all the way through the employment sector, you start there, and then it's what you're trying to achieve and then what strategies make sense in light of what you're trying to achieve.
Yes.
That question is a different question, albeit with a lot of similarity and commonality across a number of institutions, from institution to institution. And so the simple point is, this can't be understood as sort of generic across-the-board cookie-cutter legal advice.
Absolutely. Thank you for that clarification. Next question. Do we have a next question?
I'm ready to do a question if you can hear me. I don't know whether she
can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, this is Penny Gilmer from Florida State University.
Mm-hmm.
Mine isn't so much a question. It was in response to the person from Science Magazine who asked for recommendations of model programs, and I just wanted to mention the advanced programs that are funded by the National Science Foundation. There's a number of institutions that had institutional transformation grants in the beginning.
Yes.
There's now a new book on this, relatively new book, from the University of Michigan team, and I've been very impressed with what they've done. They've come to my institution at Florida State University to tell us about it, and I'd recommend that book. So I don't really have a question. I'm responding to what he asked.
Thank you for that. Let me respond, and then there may be others on the panel who would like to respond. The advanced program was one that the team did examine because it has been an experiment on a variety of campuses, and because it's been in existence for about 10 years.
That's right.
So there are lessons. And it's one of the better documented programs as well. And it's a good example of what Art Coleman just said. It's the adaptation of a set of principles or ingredients to different institutional conditions, but with the goal of trying to transform the entire institution. So I think there are many lessons there. And I know Shirley and I have been involved in some of these projects. So Shirley, you may want to add.
Yes, I just want to say is every one of the ones in which I have been involved is different, and it's supposed to be, because they are all responding to a different context, to different problems, to different kinds of circumstances, to different disciplines, etc. But there are some things where all of them meet, and they tend to meet around things that do get into the larger legal questions. And that is that oftentimes there are poorly documented processes with regard to hiring, with regard to promotion, with regard to support for people, with regard to annual review of candidates. There are questions, there are strategies that are often put in place that have been determined as effective in other settings, such as not being too narrow in terms of the search process and being open to looking at multiple positions at one time and what have you, that have been effective in that regard. But this is another one of those cases that I think that Art reminded us of, and that is that because it works here, you can look at it, but it has to basically be adapted in light of what the circumstances are within a particular institution or department or what have you. It can't just be one size fits all. But the notion of building from a problem statement and looking at possible strategies that could be put in place to address individual problems is absolutely right on.
Thank you, Shirley. Well, the queue has filled, which means that people have better questions than the ones we've been asking. Operator, if you would send the next one. Hello?
Your next question comes from the line of Joyce Jones with Diverse Issues Education.
Hello. I'm wondering if there have been many recent challenges to diversity programs or efforts to diversify faculties and the student populations?
Well, this is a perfect question for our lawyers. So which of our lawyers would like to weigh in on this first?
Well, this is Bob Burgoyne. I'll speak to the faculty side.
Good.
And one of the great things about this handbook really is the as a resource tool, the second half of it, the appendix, contains most of the significant cases that have come along, including some cases as recent as 2009 involving challenges and diversity, legal challenges and diversity. So I'd refer you there. I don't know of any significant legal challenges that have gotten a great deal of publicity in the faculty area involving diversity within the past 2 to 4 years, say. So I think it is, you know, there may well be pending cases out there.
Bob, how about the New Haven firefighters case and the sort of implicit effect on the search process? You want to say a word or two about that?
Sure. It's the Ritchie v. DeStefano case. It didn't involve academics. It was a case that a lot of you may have seen involving promotion of firefighters and the use of an exam, which when the results were tallied was not generating very many minority candidates in the pool, so the city of New Haven abandoned the test results. Its real lesson in terms of sort of our universe and higher education is that you should make your decisions once you've set your process in place and have your strategies in place for recruiting and trying to get as many minority and women candidates into the pool. You shouldn't change the process at the tail end in order to address issues where you're concerned about how your initial efforts have played out.
Mm-hmm.
You should, you know, get your plan in place and then stick with it. And what the Supreme Court said in that case is you have to have a very strong basis in the record to make race-based decisions at the tail end of a process because you're concerned that your process may otherwise have a discriminatory effect.
Are there comments on this one?
I would just add, this is Art, from a student mm-hmm. perspective, things have been, at least from what we think we know, modestly quiet. There is a case percolating through the federal courts right now involving the University of Texas on some admissions-related issues, but that is the only one sort of post Michigan beyond one that several years ago involved the University of Washington Law School, and you'll see these referenced in the materials. I think the other point I would just add here beyond the federal courts or state courts, as the case may be, to keep your eye on policy that may emanate from the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. I think the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights indicated several weeks ago or maybe a month or so ago now, that there may be activity coming from that office in terms of Dear Colleague and related policy mm-hmm. guidance. We've just seen some in a different field involving athletics under Title IX. But that may be one arena to keep your eyes posted on just as we watch the court opinions as they generate from claims that get filed.
Good. Thank you. Let's go to another question.
Your next question comes from the line of Maureen Rojo with American Chemical Society.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yes. My question is, what is the practical impact of this that you are aiming for, and do you have any plans of measuring the impact or following up on what this tremendous effort, you know, what kind of impact it would have?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn to Jamie on this one because we built in some monitoring and accountability as part of the two workshops that we ran with the AAU institutions. Jamie, you want to comment further?
Sure. I think that what we hope to achieve here is to support the creation of a truly productive partnership between the legal leaders of academic institutions and the academic administrators and policy leaders. because we realize that that if we want to have successful diversity efforts, we're going to have things that efforts that really work, approaches that really work to increase diversity. But those efforts have to be sustainable against legal challenges in order for institutions to feel comfortable pursuing them, and in order to sustain them over time. So I think these materials are intended to be tools for both the lawyers, because the materials provide very in-depth legal guidance, and also for the policymakers and administrators, because we have described, for instance, in the search process, we have some specific steps that can be taken to address some of the issues that the firefighters case, the Ricci case, put forward. And I think that that one of the things that our project hopes to do and intends to do is to periodically update these resources so that they remain fresh, and as we learn lessons through hard decisions and that occur in the courts or through the administering agencies in the government, we do hope to be able to update the materials. And that's something that at AAAS and others are planning.
Shirley, you may have a non-legal response
yes,
to
I
this
do.
Question.
I do. This is like the dog that didn't bark. because quite frankly, what I would like to see is a movement around the issue of diversity that in fact is accomplished without a lot of lawsuits or, you know, other legal entanglements. It done in ways that are fair, that are respectful of the law, and that's something that we will all basically be monitoring by looking at the numbers and at the changes in the numbers. We have only, however, scratched the surface in terms of the institutions where we have where we've actually worked with the teams of individuals. There's a lot more colleges and universities out there who really need the kind of conversation that we have been able to have with the AAU teams so that they can begin to understand how these things would operate in different kinds of institutions and in different kinds of settings where there are different issues that may be emerging. And I think that is the non-legal response to that.
To Shirley's point, this is really technical assistance, and it needs to be done campus at a time. So in no way are we saying that what works at a research university necessarily transfers willy-nilly to another kind of institution. And we've already had expressed interest by a number of higher education associations to work with us for the purpose of making these materials relevant to their particular cases and situations. Let's turn to another question.
Your next question comes from the line of Kathy Phillips with the National Post.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm with the National Postdoctoral Association. And first, I want to say thank you so much for this handbook, and especially thank you for including postdocs in the handbook. That's a real gap that this is helping to fill. I also appreciate the classifications, the factors that courts might look at to determine whether a postdoc is an employee or a graduate student, And I wondered, this is probably asking a question that might put you way out on a limb, but I wonder if you all had any opinions on whether it would be better to classify a postdoc as an employee or as a student.
Let me turn to Bob first, because if we're going out on a limb, I always turn to Bob first. and then we'll allow Art and Jamie to weigh in on this too. Bob?
Sure. The reality in a litigation context is that regardless of what you call the particular individual, employee or not, the court will look at a variety of factors to try to figure out what the real relationship is. My general sense from putting this handbook together was that there are oftentimes any number of administrative constraints that drive the classification above and beyond, you know, how it might impact your goals in a diversity context? You know, as I think Shirley alluded to, are you going to get benefits for those individuals, and how do you characterize their stipends? Is it a salary, or is it, you know, more akin to a scholarship? Mm-hmm. So I think from a legal perspective, while having the label of student and not employer would help to keep it into the in the camp of a student relationship, and that in turn gives us a little more comfort on the diversity front, mm-hmm. It's probably going to be other factors mm-hmm. that drive it.
Jamie?
I totally agree with Bob. I think I don't have a lot to add. I think that's mm-hmm. exactly right. Legally, it might be better to have the arguments that can support student diversity, but practically there are lots of other institutional considerations that really drive this. I just think it's important to look at to do this with intelligence, to really look at the factors and know that you're stepping into the employment camp and be able to plan for that to sustain the programs.
Good. Okay. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Ted Williams with the University of South Florida.
Good afternoon. Ted Williams, University of South Florida.
Hi.
First of all, I would echo the sentiments of the prior questioners in that I commend this body for the excellent work you've done. I'm just pulling up the document on my computer now. My question, however, relates to the fundamental concept of meritocracy, in that we have been putting forth efforts for years and years to increase the diversity in the sciences, medicine, et cetera. And when you look at the line, it's essentially been flat since 1970, coming all the way across to present day. And when one looks at evaluating applicants for a given faculty line and so forth, invariably search committees will say how many NIH grants do they have, how many pubs do they have, et cetera. And they tend to put the lion's share of the evaluation process on that particular coin of the realm. Mm-hmm. This does not yield the type of diversity that we would like to have. Given that this has not worked, yet it continues to be the coin of the realm, how do we envision changing the overall process of the concept of meritocracy?
Mm-hmm. That's a $64 question without inflation.
At least 64.
We probably have, the panel probably has a variety of responses to that. Shirley, let's start with you.
Yeah. One of the real challenges is to kind of stretch the paradigm. What constitutes quality and what constitutes, for example, what you might need in a medical school? When you are dealing with health issues, and this is something that I was actually talking with Art about a little bit earlier, you have a whole other set of questions that you can raise. To what extent is your institution and your faculty able to deal with issues of health disparities, be they gender-based, for example, issues around women's health, or are they minority-based? To what extent will the faculty as currently constituted, or in a kind of a non-diverse, looking at it holistically, to what extent are they able to address larger issues of cultural competence? Because if they've got to treat a diverse set of patients or disease conditions, et cetera, do they have the skill set as a faculty to begin to address some of these issues? And I think that if we can begin to shift some of the discussion, and the science is actually moving in a way to allow us to shift some of the discussions. There was actually an article in Science Magazine, a news article, a couple of weeks ago, I think it was the 26th March edition, that it was entitled, Of Mice and Women. and it was looking at the whole question of male laboratory animals, rats and mice, and the extension of the findings that come from that, their applicability to human disease conditions, and the extension of those findings beyond males. And so as we began to look at the science itself and began to question can we get here from here kind of questions, and looking holistically at what the faculty are expected to bring, I think that it allows the conversation to shift in ways that we really haven't been able to shift it in the past.
Jamie, before I go to Art, because we have a piece in the handbook on multicultural skills, you might want to elaborate a little bit on this. I mean, what we're talking about are new criteria or additional criteria, which are, of course, very hard to introduce alongside the symbolism of federal agency funding and publication productivity. But it's something that needs to be considered.
Well, I think that one of the things that's pointed out is that in a global and increasingly diverse world, all of our students and all of our faculty, regardless of race or gender or other characteristics, need to be able to work in a very diverse environment productively, creatively, and collaboratively, because science and technology are creative, collaborative fields. And if we really want to do an excellent job of education, if we want to produce the best research that is actually looking at problems and identifying issues from different perspectives, we need to have a diverse faculty and a diverse student body. So although this is not instead of, as Daryl is mentioning, these are additional characteristics that make up the whole person. And we need to be looking for faculty and students who will bring the ability to communicate well and work well and produce well with lots of different people into our academic environments. And if we look for those skills, that conduct of inclusion, and not only to include people but to use differences as a way of issue spotting and problem solving and exploration, then we're going to be more productive. The quality of the institution will increase. And there's actually a piece, I think Yale University actually has described this very nicely in a policy statement that is highlighted in the materials. I think it may be on page 55, and so that might be one place to look for this.
Yeah, I have it before me.
Of course, to Ted Williams' question, what we really are talking about here is how to expand the definition of merit.
Exactly.
And then how does one change the culture of how one conducts a search, and what are the things that get differential weighting here?
Exactly.
And we all know how difficult that is, particularly since faculty searches happen unit by unit, not even, college by college or full department by full department. So this is a very knotty one. I appreciate the question. I think Art had something to add.
Yeah, let me just play off. I could not agree more with Shirley when she says, at core, Ted, this is about shifting the conversation. I think that's exactly right, and I think we actually say this in the manual, but I think that the simple point here is this cannot be, as I think sometimes it has been in the past, understood as diversity for diversity's sake.
Mm-hmm.
This cannot be understood as diversity defined narrowly. And I think the real question, and Shirley's medical school example really tees this up nicely, but it's a broader question, obviously, than just medical schools, is what do you as an institution value?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of graduates do you want to produce?
Right.
You back map it against what I refer to probably too colloquially as the end game. What is success? when you are producing the kind of students and citizens you want to produce in the 21st century. That should then drive the question about what diversity looks like and then what steps you need to take and maybe some steps you don't need to take because you're achieving success some places. But I think importantly the nugget here is it's not diversity for diversity's sake. It's not a question of political correctness. It's about a national and institutional imperative tied to the very factors that others have talked about. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Darryl, I just might mention here that when the Science Board basically modified its criteria.
The National Science Board.
Yeah.
Right.
When the National Science Board modified its criteria for award of grants from the National Science Foundation, I think that that began a signal of what besides the traditional values of merit as we have traditionally thought about it, what else are you bringing to the table? And I do think that there may be a larger set of discussions that are likely to take place over time across the agencies with regard to these broader impacts kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's too easy to count the amount of grant money.
Right.
It's too easy to count the numbers of publications.
Right.
And a colleague of mine, a number of years ago, Lauren Resnick, was talking about assessment, but it applies here as well. And that is that we tend to value what we can measure
exactly.
as opposed to measure what we value. And so when Art said you've got to get to this core question of what is it that that medical student needs to look like, what is it that this core of medical research needs to be focusing on, that those are the larger questions of what we
right.
value.
And once you define all those things, there's some fairly practical guidance on how you can incorporate those kinds of considerations into the search process. If you look at the race-neutral alternative mm-hmm. section under multicultural skills and inclusive conduct in the materials.
Let me just note that we're an hour into this teleconference, and there are a couple of callers waiting. I would urge the panel to try to provide very brief responses to questions, okay?
Darryl, you're talking to lawyers here.
I know. I'm trying very hard, and I'm losing the battle. But I knew that before we started. Operator, next.
Your next question comes from the line of Becky Hamm with AAAS.
I just wanted to follow up on something that had been said earlier about the sort of relative quiet in the courts after the Michigan decisions, and I wonder if there's an easy explanation for that, or is it just a matter of time, or what's going on with that? Why is it so quiet right now?
I think the lawyers have a couple of hypotheses about this. Who wants to take this first?
All right, you can start.
Thanks, Bob. Now I get to go out on the limb. who's got the saw? I would be speculating if I misrepresenting if I pretended to really know the answer to that question. I will say I think we're in a period of still sort of reflection and refinement post-Michigan because, after all, remember Michigan in 2003 told us for the first time what a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court thought about the consideration of race in a higher education admissions context, which obviously has some broader applicability as the guidance discusses. And while there have been a number of isolated cases, and frankly, I should have said, a few more of those filed with OCR, although that tends to get less publicity and is often resolved without formal federal findings. I think people are sort of taking stock and figuring out where you are, and there are a number of institutions, obviously, that are continuing to look at policies and evolve policies. I will also say, I think if you look at the big picture, I think part of the battle, to the extent this issue gets polarized or politicized, which is, frankly, an arena I try to avoid because I think there's a lot of ample common ground politically, educationally, and as a matter of law. The shift that has occurred that's notable is you see relatively less focus in the courts, and you're now in the court of public opinion. You now have the initiatives led by Ward Connerly and others to take this issue on a number of state referenda, most but not all of which have succeeded. And so there has been, in a sense, an evolution from this legal baseline to a question of where can we win or not, if you frame it in that way, in the political context.
So that's the question of risk.
Yes.
Right. What could you possibly have to lose by bringing one of these cases forward? Jamie, a thought?
What would you have to,
in general, in response. I mean, why do you think that there haven't been more cases that have come forward?
Well, I think if you look at the history of these cases, they don't happen every year. Mm-hmm. And if the Michigan cases happened 25 years after the Bakke case in 1978. Right. So the important cases come up every so often. I think Art is absolutely right that there is more of a political move. And I think one of the things that we have tried to articulate in the handbook and I think is very important is that the kind of diversity that we need for the nation in science and technology fields is not necessarily one that aligns with one political perspective. It's something that industry leaders and universities and government leaders all recognize as being critical to because we need the best intellectual resources that the country has to offer. Mm-hmm. And so I think that one of the challenges that we have is to communicate about this issue in a way that is effective across political perspectives.
Okay. Let's try to squeeze in one or two more. Operator?
Your next question comes from the line of Janet Coster with Association of Women in Science.
Hello, Daryl, Shirley, and Art. It's so great to hear all of you. We miss you very much. I'm so pleased to see that the new handbook is out. I haven't had a chance to read through it, but my question very quickly is the application of Title IX. It always receives so much attention with regard to athletics and really is not recognized, its applicability is not recognized in the academic with regard to academics, and I'm just wondering what the stance is of the lawyers when they have discussions with the universities, because Title IX is the law.
Which of the lawyers would like to field this one?
I'll start just to simply say indeed it is, and I think those questions actually squarely surface when you've got an issue of gender underrepresentation or potentially gender preference or a set of strategies that may be gender specific or gender neutral designed to get you to a point that you think you're actually meeting educational goals. And I think we made every effort, and I get the notion of the myth of people thinking it's all about athletics, to outline in some detail the relevant sort of corresponding but not identical standard associated with Title IX vis-a-vis Title VI and race provisions emanating from constitutional prohibitions. So I think the bottom line is you will see when you digest these materials that Title IX is squarely there and treated independently. But with the sort of notable alignment broadly around the questions of race and national mm-hmm. origin, because frankly, we've got some definitive guidance from the Supreme Court, or apparently definitive, on race, and we don't have all of those answers yet on gender.
Let me follow up on Janet's question with one to Bob. Do you expect more to be said or contested about Title IX in the next couple of years?
Well, Art mentioned earlier it's gotten a little bit of attention lately from the agency, and so it's sort of back in the news. You know, in the employment context, you've got Title VII, which also prohibits sex discrimination, so it ends up not getting as much play, even though in the employment context, Title IX is also relevant. I don't know that in the employment context you will begin to see a great deal of Title IX.
Mm-hmm.
Litigation in the faculty context.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to one last question, operator.
Your final question comes from the line of Judith Weiss with Record University.
Hi, Daryl.
Hello.
The question I had when I pushed this thing was when Penny was talking about advanced grants, and we've gone so far past that that I think we can just skip this question.
Do you want to ask anything else? That's fine.
No, that's okay.
Okay, Judy. Glad you were on.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
And operator, is there anybody else on, or are we done?
At this time, there are no further questions.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Let me then thank the panel and all the callers for joining us on the release of the AAASAAU handbook. The handbook, as you know, is posted in modular form free of charge at the AAAAS Capacity Center website, which is www.AAASCapacity.org. You can also go to AAAAS.org, where it is linked. For any more information on the project, you can contact Ginger Pinholster, whose phone number is 202-326-6421. Thanks again, and goodbye.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.